Well, good day, everybody. Paul Von Gertz here with the news from Knife River. At least the news the way I see it, I write the newsletter for the Knife River Heritage and Cultural Center. And so there's obviously some Heritage Center news here. There's some history, and maybe you'll find some of this entertaining. What I try to do with the newsletter is make it apparent that history can be fun and interesting. And I hope you feel that way, too, all you radio listeners. All right, here we go with March from the reading from the Knife River Heritage Cultural Center newsletter. My name is Paul Von Gertz, live in Knife River, celebrating our 50th year in Knife River, and probably someday we'll be accepted by the locals. Okay, here we go. Well, work begins on our fishing exhibit this spring. In the February issue, we told you the Heritage Center was going to build a fishing exhibit this summer where the 35-foot fish tug Crusader II will be placed. At the same time, restoration of the fish tug will begin. We're inspired by the commercial fishing exhibit designed and built by the National Park Service that covers fish tug called Twilight, which is a little sand bay of the Apostle Islands. The National Seashore boat the display is really quite nice, and I wish I could show you a picture of it, but this is radio, so I can't. Anyway, the Twilight is much like Crusader. It's 35 foot long. And this exhibit was able to take advantage of a sloping knoll to partially recess the boat into a below-grade, what I call bathtub. And so no viewing ramp was needed. The boat was kind of recessed into the ground, but not with soil piled around it. It was sitting in a bathtub, so to speak. Well, Crusader will have a decorative fence around it, too, and interpretive signs, as does the Twilight display in Little Sand Bay. Now, we're going to leave the exhibit uncovered until 2023, a year from the summer, for several reasons. Well, leaving the exhibit uncovered will let visitors see a boat restoration in progress. Of particular interest will be steam bending of the gunwale rails and hull planks that need to be replaced. Steam bending is fast becoming a lost art. Once a slab is laid down and Crusader placed on it, a viewing deck will be built alongside it and parallel to the length of the boat, so that visitors can see the interior of the boat, which we hope to bring back to the way it looked in its commercial fishing days. So, the first use of the deck will be to provide a safe staging area for those who are working to restore the boat. And without a cover over their heads, workers such as myself will have full access to the boat's cabin and topsides. Oh, we thought that all made sense. Another reason for putting down the slab and the deck viewing deck this summer is that it works out with our timing and our friends at North House Folk School in Grand Marais. Some of you may be familiar with the North House Folk School. They teach post and beam construction, also boat building, very interesting place. Well, our plan is to have the North House Folk School conduct a class in post and beam construction during the summer of 2023, and then erect the framing over the exhibit later in the summer. So I'd like to show you what the North House Folk School came up with as far as the design. It's beautiful. It's got some dormers on it. We really like the design they came up with. It features a distinctive Nordic flair and also emphasizes the natural beauty of wood and frame construction. We have their dormers on it, part of the design, which will allow visitors to get a better view of the boat's topsides. So anyway, the Heritage Center will contract out the metal roof to match that of the depot and freight house. Okay, so we worked out the design for the framework so it'll support the roof last summer, and now classes will be offered in 2023. Now, we're hoping grants will provide most of the funding for the exhibit and its cover. That's all based on we have an equal amount of one-to-one match money. That's the thing, you know. People say, well, you get grant money and everything's cool, but a lot of these grants are one-to-one matches, okay? So if we want to get $20,000, we have to put in $20,000 ourselves. So we do ask for help in this regard. The Knife River Heritage Center is a 501c3, so all donations are fully tax-deductible. Speaking of Crusader, here's more on Crusader 1. I've been talking about Crusader 2. Some people are interested. Well, what about Crusader 1? Well, there was a Crusader 1. In last month's talk here, I told readers the history of Crusader 2 and touched briefly on Crusader 1. Well, we've ever since received more information on Crusader 1, thanks to Bill Berg, our Knife River resident naturalist, who's taken a great interest in Knife River fish tugs and skiffs. Well, Bill sent me photos of Crusader that he had copied from Skip Bizzle from Knife River, his scrapbook. Okay, so those were very nice. That's the nice thing about writing these stories that people get back to me. They say, you know, I've got a picture of that boat. Anyway, Skip was interesting. He was a five-year-old boy at the time that the Crusader was built in 1939. It just so happened, and I've said this before in other incidents, that the Crown Prince of Norway, Crown Prince Olaf, was in Minnesota in 1939. And just wanted to see what influence there was of Norwegian Americans in Minnesota, and in particular along the North Shore. And so it was agreed that the best way to see that sort of Norwegian Scandinavian, Norwegian American influence would be in Knife River. So he was here in June of 1939, and he christened the boat. He was supposed to go out on the lake and do some fishing, but the weather was inclement. So that was kind of interesting. So that's why Skip has particular ties to Crusader 2. Well, okay, back to Crusader 1. The boat was built by the Hill family of boat builders in Larsmont in 1930 and delivered to Carl Erickson of Knife River as an open gas boat. And in the photos that I've seen, it appeared to be about 20 feet long, which would be about the longest a gas boat, open gas boat would be. Okay, the North Shore Commercial Fishing Museum said the boat was 35 feet as it, and describes it as a cab over, but this would not coincide with the history Skip had and with the picture as well. We'll just leave that issue alone. Now, many boats built by the Hill family and other boat builders were delivered as open boats with the idea the owner could come up with his own deck and cabin design. Well, someone once said, probably a Swede, that a Norwegian could not build a square fish box. And that may be true as I look at the two modifications Carl made to Crusader 1. Now, apparently, he wasn't thrilled with his work either, which may explain why he commissioned the Hills to build Crusader 2 in 1939, complete with a cabin. So I've got pictures here, which I just, you know, try the best I can to describe. One is with a partial cabin forward on the Crusader 1, and the second one shows a complete cabin. So apparently Carl kind of thought better of the open boat and wanted some kind of protection. But again, a lot of the boat builders delivered a boat, and then the owner would put his own cabin configuration on it. But as I look at this picture here of Crusader 1, it looks to be a bit top-heavy with that cabin, and I wonder if it rolled much in a seaway. I think it would. Not to be critical. All right, it's official. The Heritage Center signs a 20-year lease with the Regional Rail Authority. So we've got a lease for 20 years, good to 2042. Well, any project, the scope of the depot restoration would attract naysayers. You know a few around here on the North Shore? A couple comments we remember are, quote, the Rail Authority will never give you a lease. Well, they did. A five-year renewable in 2018 at $1 a year. Well, then after we started the restoration, we heard, you'll build it and they'll not renew your lease and so they will own it. Well, I think this 20-year renewable lease at $1 a year we just negotiated settles both those arguments quite nicely. Well, I can hear the next naysayer say, $1 a year? Are you crazy? What's wrong with 50 cents? Good grief. Anyway, I included a Chinese proverb with the story. It says, quote, the person who says it cannot be done should not interrupt the person doing it. How true. Now, the next story is one I kind of hesitated to tell, but I'm going to tell it anyway, of course. It's called the Great Knife River Record Steelhead Hoax. And with that, I have this quote. Oh, what a tangled net we weave when first we practice to deceive, attributed to Sir Walter Scott. As I said, I deliberated whether or not to retell the story as a rather bizarre piece of Knife River history and debatably part of its culture, of which we in Knife River may not be too proud. But we must remember that the Heritage Center is the repository for Knife River's history and culture. So therefore, as this story is both history and culture, I feel obligated to record for future generations this story. So to protect those involved, I will give you the dots which you can try to connect to arrive at the whole story. Now, my source for the story are the brother-in-law of the one I will refer to as R.H. Now, R.H. is not the individual's initials. And also the St. Paul Pioneer Press, which certainly is credible. First, understand that Knife River has a long history of fish poaching. perhaps because early commercial fishermen were frustrated by fishing limits placed on them by state and federal agencies when they felt fishing stocks were more than adequate. As a result, they relied on square hooks. And I'm talking in code when I say square hooks. So fishermen relied on square hooks placed in otherwise restricted areas to even the score with government agencies. Hang on, I'm trying to turn a page here. Still trying to turn a page. Okay, got it. And so it was in the dark of night in the spring of 1974 that square hooks were run across the Knife River near the mouth. Whoever placed it was amazed at the size of the steelhead flopping in it just before he lifted it before sunrise. He wanted to weigh it, so-called RH. Now, RH was an enthusiastic steelhead angler and also had a high school friend who certified scales, and so the lunker got weighed. It weighed a whopping 17 pounds, 6 ounces. Well, from here, the story gets a bit more involved. RH couldn't contain his excitement about the big fish and told a few steelhead friends about it. Once they saw it, they convinced him that he should claim ownership of it, submit the certified weight to the DNR, and if it was a state record, bragging rights would forever be his. Well, to support this dubious suggestion, they pointed out the fish had no markings from flopping around in the square hooks. Its weight was confirmed on a recently certified scale, and he already was recognized as an accomplished steelheader. So that's what RH did. Surprisingly, I think, the state DNR accepted his documentation and was indeed a record steelhead, state record. So now you know how I refer to him as RH, record holder. Well, ever since 1974, I would get my yearly fishing license with trout stamp and the rule book that came with it. In that book was a list of all the state record catches and for different species, and under steelhead, there was the weight of RH of steelhead and where it was caught. Well, it was a good laugh for all of us who knew how the fish was really caught. Well, during the winter of 2002 and 2003, RH, who is now facing life-threatening illness, told a friend who certified, well, the friend who certified a fish, that he's going to pull his record. He didn't say why, only that he had been, quote, bothered by it far too long, unquote. Well, RH died shortly thereafter. Now, I knew RH, and he was not a bad person. He was a good guy. But there's more to the story. Now, according to Chris Niskanen, writing in the St. Paul Pioneer Press in May of 2003, now, in 1980, a man by the name of Scott Thorpe caught a monster steelhead in Lake Superior. It weighed 16 pounds, 6 ounces, but he didn't bother to register because the record caught by RH was bigger at 17 pounds, 6 ounces. So he mounted the fish, put it on his wall to remind him of a great day of fishing on Lake Superior. Well, when Thorpe read about the record steelhead being withdrawn by RH, I read about it too, it was in the Duluth News Tribune, he made an attempt to claim the record steelhead, only to learn the scale used to weigh his fish back in 1980 had burned in a fire, and the guy who regularly certified fish had retired. So that was the end of that idea. Well, in case you're wondering, the state steelhead record today is 16 pounds, 6 ounces, caught in Devil Track River near Cook, also 1980. So, but we Knife River people can at least claim the largest steelhead, quote, taken, unquote, in Minnesota waters, and that was from the Knife River at 17 pounds, 6 ounces. And so, my fellow anglers and listeners, that is the great Knife River record steelhead hoax. Now, as an addendum to this story, it may have been sometime in the early 80s when I was approached by native Knife River if I would object if he ran 100 feet of square hooks out from the beach we have on our property after dark with the assurance it would be pulled before dawn. Now, I should not have even entertained this idea. Well, I pondered it and concluded it sounded rather adventuresome, and I was curious as to how the hooks would be run out and what we might catch. Square hooks were conveniently found in the size for lake trout, 2.5-inch opening. I had the raft and all was set to go for a moonless night. Then about 2 days prior to executing our plan, the DNR spread the story through town that the next Knife River person caught poaching would be fined $1,000 and placed on Lake County Slammer for 3 days, period. Well, that was the end of that idea. Something about steelhead. Many know they're not native to Lake Superior. They were introduced in the mid-1890s by state and federal agencies concerned about declining native populations of native brook trout. Well, thankfully, they now reproduce naturally and have established a self-sustaining population. Okay, one more story here. A fellow by the name of Martin Checklin. I call him Knife River's master carpenter of whimsy. And this picture, this story kind of relies on photos, which obviously I can't show you, but I can try to describe them best I can. Well, ever since making Knife River our home some 50 years ago, I've been curious about the architectural detail of certain buildings that resemble something from a fairyland. In short, I'll call it whimsical. There are at least three examples of which I am writing. Well, one is the most evident. Martin's distinctive architecture embellishments can be seen in Smoky Kendall's on the south side of 61. And while the other two examples of Martin's work are barely visible, the first is that little there's a little house across from Kendall's at the entrance to Kendall Road. And the second, the remnants of what appears to be a replica of a lighthouse with an octagonal top where the light would be, is on private property and can only be seen from the water along the Knife River shoreline. Well, I talked to several of Knife River's older residents about these buildings and learned that Martin Checklin built them about 65 to 71 years ago. I'm not sure about the spelling of Checklin. It may not be correct. I spelled it just the way it sounds, C-H-E-C-K-L-I-N. Well, lifetime Knife River resident Audrey Carlson remembers Martin built and lived in a small house across from Kendall's at the entry to Kendall Road. And she remembers walking past it on her way to the Knife River School. I don't remember much about him, said Audrey. He worked at Kendall's mostly outside and as a handyman. He was old back then and had a long white beard. He stayed pretty much to himself. Well, from what I understand, Martin was a skilled carpenter and used only hand tools. My guess, he was a pretty creative guy and perhaps a romantic, judging by building embellishments right out of some fairy book. Lowell Smoky Kendall family members at Martin Checklin, along with their dad, Lowell Sr., had indeed collaborated on the design and construction of Smoky Kendall's some 60 to 70 years ago, and he always used hand tools. Okay, and now the lighthouse replica appeared to be somewhat structurally sound when Mayor and I first saw it in the water, from the water, in the early 70s. It's along the Knife River Watch shoreline. But the lower section, which supported the towers, collapsed, and only octagonal light platform is just barely visible through the undergrowth. Now it's on private property and only can be seen from the water along the Knife River shoreline. Interesting. Okay, I'm hoping that readers of the newsletter can give more insight into Martin Checklin. Almost all Knife River elders with whom I have spoken remember him, but with little or no recall of who he was. Maybe he was just a private romantic and preferred to live in a world of his own. I'm encouraging anyone with a photo or more information on Martin Checklin to please send it to, please send, email it to me at info@krhcc.org, and I will include it in a future issue. Well, that's about what I have for news from Knife River. I kept it under 20 minutes, which is what I had hoped to do. I'll be back again next month. I've got some interesting stories we're working on. Things are kind of coming along with plans for the summer months. We've got some events scheduled, North Shore Scenic Trains coming in June. Those are picnic trains, sold out last year every Saturday, with the exception of Grandma's Marathon Saturday. The trains will be running from Duluth to Knife River. As I said, last year it sold out, and I think this year they'll have more cars available so more people can enjoy that. That'll be in our newsletter next month, and let me just kind of wrap things up here, and thank you so much for listening. I'll be back again next month at this time, and more news for you that I hope you'll enjoy.